screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Hey everyone out there in Radioland, welcome back to The Goods, a film podcast. Although longtime listeners may note that this is our annual April 1st installment. We're actually sitting down to record on the day, though you'll hear it a little bit after the fact. And on April Fool's, what do we do, Dan?
One of my favorite annual traditions. Quite honestly, maybe my favorite annual tradition in the sense of the things that we talk about are just like much more unusual and different and interesting from my perspective than some of our other annual traditions, even, although I like all of our annual traditions. But anyways, what we do is we each share with the other. We've called it different things. I like quasi film or not quite a film, something that is typically a recorded video that can be watched, but is not actually what one would call a film. And so why don't we briefly recap what we've done in past April Fools'es? We did Heavy Metal Parking Lot. We did, what's the date of the Garfield one? The hour-long Garfield review?
7/27/1978.
That was our first year. Our second year, I brought The Basketball Game. And
I think that was It's Potty Time for me. The potty training tape.
Oh, two greats. Yeah. And then last year I brought Vines, the 6-second videos. We talked about it as a medium and then a specific collection. And remind me, what did you bring, Brian?
Wow. We got to go back to the record books. I don't even remember. I remember talking Vine. Was that? No, that wasn't Henry's Kitchen because that was for my birthday. It was Hamburger Game.
That's what it was. It was Hamburger Game.
About the Japanese guys driving around Los Angeles eating 10 hamburgers.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to be another fun one for us.
I concur. Because whereas last year we watched something 6 seconds long, this year I assigned something 6 hours long. A YouTube video that it takes 6 hours to watch, or maybe longer than that if you take it in several sittings.
This is one we've been talking about for a while, Brian. So why don't you tell us about it?
Yes. So this specific YouTube video is Action Button Reviews Tokimeki Memorial. And I know I've made numerous references to it over the years, and I wanted to give some context, because this video dropped on New Year's Day 2021, so the 1st of January of that year, peak, just mid-pandemic season, when it seemed it would never end. It was just dragging on. We were still wearing masks and things. But this placed it squarely in the time in our podcast history that we could have had it as an assignment for Time Loop Month, which happened in February of 2021, our very first theme month. But at that point, we hadn't broken all the ground possible. We hadn't gotten to that level yet in our relationship, Dan, that I felt comfortable assigning a 6-hour YouTube video for the podcast. And also, we had never had an April Fool's episode at that point. It was just a twinkle in our eye.
That's right.
But listeners will remember that it's come up in discussion, because this video definitely made an impact on me. I think it's got a lot of good material to talk about. It's just got a lot of material in general. It's very long. Its length becomes its own statement in a way.
So I think this is now the longest YouTube video that I've ever watched. And I'll just say that I basically had two options. One was to watch it at 1x and be doing other things while I watched, which would mean I wouldn't necessarily absorb all of it, or to watch it at faster than 1x. So 1.5x or 2x or something. And then I could probably like have my face on the screen for the entirety of the 6 hours thus compressed. But I felt like what was more in the spirit was the former, to basically let it play at 1x, even if I wasn't fully engaged with it. Now, if I had planned my time better, then maybe I could have found that time and devoted my full 100% attention to the 1.0x speed playthrough of this. But I don't know about you, Brian. I'm really busy right now. I traveled. I have all this work going on. I have all this stuff I'm trying to do for my blog and for the podcast. And it was hard to find time to do this, Brian.
Yes. So I think that approach works well. Carry it with you through your day. Carry your tablet around or your phone or whatever you're listening to. Take it in while you're brushing your teeth or writing your emails. How many times do you think I've experienced this YouTube video, Dan?
Oh, man. Well, it seems like two is not going to be the right answer. That would be my initial guess because you watched it when it came out and then in prep for this. But I'll put that as my guess, and then I assume that's going to be wrong.
This was number four.
Oh, man. That's a whole day's
worth. Fourth time, yes. So about once a year, I feel the inspiration.
Is there anything that you consume at higher than 1.0x speed?
Usually summoning salt videos I will speed up. And then if it's something I have to watch for a class, sometimes I will speed it up.
Okay.
Also, the third time I watched the Jeffrey Dahmer show on Netflix, I sped that up.
Gotcha. You watched it three times. I thought you didn't even like that.
Oh, no, I thought it was good. Well, what did I say? I guess I did wonder at the time. I think I opined on how could something so dark and violent become like mass marketed entertainment. But I thought it was a really good character study.
Interesting.
Good performances by Evan Peters and the guy who plays the dad, who was one of the office lackeys in Cabin in the Woods. And also, I think he was the dad in Step Brothers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forget his name, but I know who I can see his face.
Yeah, distinctive character actor who pops up from time to time.
Richard Jenkins.
Yes. But we are here to talk about Action Button. Action Button is the persona, the like in-house production team of video game journalist Tim Rogers, who is this man who was 41 in 2021, or I guess late 2020. So approximately 10 years older than me and 8 years older than Dan. So he was a teenager in the 90s. Then he got into Japanese culture and went to Japan, worked for the Sony company as a game developer, and then focused on game journalism, and I believe ended up back in America.
And there was a lot of things that I kind of brought to this that I'll bring up some of them as we go, is that my brother Will spent a lot of time in Japan, and I think I kept thinking of him when he was talking about his time in Japan.
Yeah, I feel like Tim Rogers' perspective was probably in demand. Like, I feel if you're the person who has lived in America and then you go and you are like involved in development, and he didn't say that he worked on regionalization, but I feel like he'd be like a key guy that you'd want to talk to if you were like looking for an outside perspective as a Japanese developer. I mean, who knows, but it seemed like he definitely found his niche. Wikipedia says he's known for his verbose style. and that he writes these contemplative essays. He's almost like a journalistic approach unto himself, that he writes these memoirs, pulls his own history into discussion of the game, of the work that he's critiquing. A couple points before we dive into what's actually in this video. So I have assigned a review on the podcast before, but we didn't give it a rating. That was Jenny Nicholson's coverage of The Greatest Showman. Dan has assigned a review that we did rate, which was John Green on Auld Lang Syne.
That is a review, although it's like, it's even more memoir than this, I would say. Like, the Jenny Nicholson one is barely even memoir at all. She mostly just talks about the movie. But the John Green one is like a history lesson combined with a reflection on his mentor that passed away.
Right. But
I guess it is a review, because he does give a review to Auld Lang Syne, a star rating to Auld Lang Syne at the end of the podcast episode.
Right. Just in case anyone thought it was too far beyond the pale for us to review a review. It's not completely unprecedented, and also on April Fool's, all bets are off.
I mean, I would argue that the Garfield one is a review of sorts, too. It's because he's kind of reviewing that strip in a sort of psychopathic way.
I guess that's true. But the pipe strip is more a way of life.
Is that more a way of life than what we watched here? I guess it is.
I just mean more so than a review.
Oh, okay. I see. It's a way of life for you.
Or for, what was his name? Not Lionel Barrymore. John Blythe Barrymore. Lionel Barrymore is what, like, great-grandnephew or something.
Right. What did he say? I'll have to look at this later.
Ah, yes. I'll have to see this later. A classic. I'll definitely be talking more about 727 before we're done here. So this video, Dan, that I had you watch, has a runtime of 5 hours and 56 minutes and 26 seconds. How does that compare to As I Was Moving Ahead?
That's a great question. I think that one is just under 5 hours, but let me look it up. It is 288 minutes, which is 4 hours and 48 minutes.
So this just blows it out of the water.
Yeah. It's got to be the longest individual thing we've watched. Although I would imagine Gravity Falls is more overall time when we watched that show.
Right. We added that up to about 1,000 minutes. So presumably more. Easier to take maybe in multiple sittings. But you may be wondering now, what is Tokimeki Memorial? And it is a dating simulator video game, which is kind of a stereotypically Japanese genre. A lot of time and virtual ink is spent explaining that this did not get an American release. It was only ever in Japan, only ever in Japanese. Now, my awareness of this genre, I mean, I was just kind of tangentially aware of it. I'd seen, like, jokes about it. And, of course, I'd seen Gravity Falls by the time I saw this video, and Gravity Falls has an episode about Japanese dating sim games. So I saw Gravity Falls for the first time in 2017. I remember because I was Grunkle Stan for Halloween that year, and also Louis C.K. was still on the soundtrack when I watched Gravity Falls the first time.
Something that has changed since then. Who did they get? Did he voice it himself, or did they get hire someone?
Alex Hirsch, yeah, himself, dubbed over. But in the spirit of bringing personal, like, date-stamped memories into the discussion, which is very much something that Tim Rogers does throughout this video, I started watching one of his other ones, and the top comment was, Tim Rogers has to think about his entire life before he reviews a game.
That's great.
Which, of course, is a reference to Walk Hard and what Dewey Cox has to do. It's the biopic approach to criticism. But this was my first deep dive into what a dating sim entails. And I guess this was really the first influential, widely played Japanese dating sim game that kind of set the template for what they were. And it was produced by Konami. So Rogers repeatedly compares it to other big Konami games of the era, like the Castlevania series. Basically saying that big name developers were involved in this thing. It came out in 1994, at which point Tim Rogers was 14. And he mentions, like, contemporary reviews of it or just discussion of the game that came out in American publications at the time, which were mostly pejorative, and said, what the hell is this Japanese weirdness? This perversion, essentially. Like, they're playing this weird porn game, is how they characterized it. And that Tim Rogers said that he felt bad for being curious about what this game might involve.
One that he brought up was Electronic Gaming Monthly. It was a magazine that wrote about it. And EGM, as it was called. Now, this 94 was before my time. I was 5 years old. I wasn't reading video game magazines. I probably read them when I was more like 13, you know, about his age, honestly. And that was like an entire generation later. But I absolutely loved Electronic Gaming Monthly. I actually bought a 10-year subscription to it one time. The magazine folded before my subscription ended, so I didn't get my full 10 years. But I like bought old issues and read them, and they were so funny. And the whole crew of writers there had this great set of personalities that really came out in their reviews. And one of the unique things they did is, instead of just having one review of each game, for every major game, they had three people write a review of it. So you're getting three different perspectives. And so you would have, like, first of all, you'd get to know the different writers a little bit more because you'd be reading more by each of them. And you just get a unique perspective on each game because you get three different angles on it, which I always thought was really cool. But then they also had really funny features where they would make fun of stuff. I mean, kind of like what he's talking about doing, making fun of Tokimeki Memorial. But I don't know. I always found it really funny and not as mean-spirited as it seemed there, but probably some of it was, and it just kind of rolled off my shoulders.
That is funny. Nothing rolls off Tim Rogers' shoulders. From what I've seen in this video, I've never watched one of his other videos. He's only got like six on this channel because they're so long and such substantial labors, but I haven't watched any of the others beyond just a couple dribs and drabs. But it seems like a commonality is playing up that he has like an eidetic memory. Like he is always living every moment of his life at once, like Dr. Manhattan. So he kind of jumps around in time and can ostensibly offer up like really detailed descriptions of what he was doing at a moment in time. But I like the way that he compares this game, Tokimeki Memorial, to the kind of wish fulfillment and escapism that is part of pretty much any video game, any simulation. He talks about other genres, racing games or fighting games or games where you fly a plane or play sports or shoot guns. And it gives you the opportunity to practice doing things that you might not do in your day-to-day life. And he describes games as trial runs of possible futures. Like, there are games where you drive cars, and it teaches you, or at least gives you the opportunity to, like, vicariously experience something that you may end up doing in your real life.
This I found to be a stretch. I mean, I feel like he kind of cherry-picked ones that it would actually apply for. But there's so many others where it's like purely speculative. Like you never actually could do it. I mean, I guess the idea is like you're putting yourself in that place and sort of imagining yourself doing it someday, even if you actually wouldn't. But I thought that was one of his more specious. I mean, I guess he was saying what he thought he did at 14 years old. So you can't really blame him too much. But yeah.
Right. But that's kind of the springboard, saying that he was 14, the age of the protagonist of this game when it starts off, and that he was heading into high school, and that talking to girls is something he would have to contend with in the immediate future. The structure of this video, it's 6 hours long, and it kind of breaks down into 6 1-hour long chunks. The first of which is introduction, just kind of saying what the video is going to be. And it's where we get a little bit of information about this journalism, the game's release in the 90s, where Rogers was at in the 90s, and a little bit about what his career has involved. There's a couple other 90s reviews that he repeatedly quotes as he dives into the game. And yeah, some of these, they come up so often that I got a little tired of them. But one is a review of Doom, which had been one of his previous reviews in this handful of like super thorough videos. And the reviewer like facetiously asked, "Why can't we talk to these creatures and reason out, like, make peace via diplomacy with the Doom monsters instead of just shooting them? Wouldn't that open up a world of video game possibilities?" Highlighting that this is going to be, like, a narrative, what do they call it, interactive novel. It's very, very much dialogue-focused, and that's going to be what creates the branching paths as dialogue trees. Another one of the reviews that he brings up time and time again was somebody critically saying that, "Oh, this is a game about women, but no women were involved." And he points out that actually there were some women involved. I don't know too much about the breakdown, but that's one that he talks about a few times.
Right. Although he does not really deny that it's basically from a male gaze. Which is kind of more to the point than the fact that there's no women involved. It's like made for male gaze, at least I thought.
That's true. Hour two digs into the premise and the structure of the game. So Tokimeki is onomatopoeia for a heartbeat. Like the original game that got reskinned in the West as Super Mario 2 is Doki Doki Panic. But more on topic is Doki Doki Literature Club, which also came out in 2017 and made a lot of headlines, but is very much like paying tribute to the established genre cliches of the dating sim and turning them on their head and turning it into a horror game.
Right. And he talks about how he thinks that that deconstruction was premature. Like, people haven't properly appreciated what a game like this actually is, and that he wishes more people would actually just play this. Although he talks a lot about how it's a shame that this has never been Americanized, you know? You can't really play it if you are only an English speaker.
Right. You have to learn a whole language if you're intent on consuming this. But the storyline of Tokimeki Memorial is that you are a Japanese high school boy, and since childhood, you have been in love with the girl next door, whose name is Shiori Fujisaki. You'll hear the name Shiori Fujisaki many, many, many times in this video. And Shiori Fujisaki, Tim Rogers tells us, is the box art girl. She's the one front and center on the cover of the game. She has long red hair. Like pinkish red anime hair. And she is the canonical true ending girl. Like, you're only going to end up with her if you do the best you can possibly do in the game. So kind of the quest that he announces is he's going to win over Shiori before the end of this 6-hour YouTube video. School legend in this world holds that the lover that you wind up with under the camphor tree on campus will be the one you live happily ever after with. Did you have any spots like this on your college campus, Dan?
Not really. We'll talk a little bit more about my romantic life as we go here. I ended up marrying my high school sweetheart, so like college romance wasn't really that much of a thing for me. I'm not aware of any romantic specific ones at the University of Virginia, though. Like, there's definitely traditions and like legends and stuff, but none about eternal love that I can recall. What about you, Brian and William and Mary?
Well, college romance was not much of a thing for me either, Dan, but the William and Mary campus definitely has one of these spots. It's called the Crim Dell. It's this bridge that goes over a little pond, and it's made out of red wood. And yeah, they say if you kiss on the Crimdell, you'll be together forever. With that in mind, you have 3 years of high school left to achieve that goal. And you can end up with one or none of 12 possible anime girls. And they all kind of fill different archetypes. So there's the art girlfriend and several different sports focused girlfriends and a few others. I mean, there's 12 of them, but Shiori is the ostensible end goal, at least when you start out.
The final boss, he calls her.
Now, the way that the game works is you spend a lot of time in your room with a calendar open. And again, I haven't played it myself, but the way that it's described is that your main action is deciding how you will spend each week. A little like Oregon Trail, it kind of seems. That you, like, make a decision and then see how the decision plays out as the wagon advances. So, like, each week on the calendar, you can choose, are you going to study a school subject, or are you going to work out, or are you going to sleep, or are you going to focus on improving your hygiene? And then, like, once you've cast that die, the week advances. Then on the weekend, you can use your phone to call up a girl and ask for a date, or you can call your male friend whose name is Yoshio. And Yoshio is really important because Yoshio keeps notes on how the girls feel about you. Because each of those things you can spend a week doing buffs one of your stats. So it's like you can put points into being good at art or being good at science or being good at sports or having good fashion or being strong. And as you raise your stats past certain thresholds, you're going to start drawing the attention of girls at your school. But each of these girls who you add to your Rolodex have designs on you. They all want you, and so they also all have opinions of you. You need to keep them all on your side and be aware of what they're thinking and feeling about you. Essentially, they're all plates that you need to keep spinning. And you need to use Yoshio's crib sheet to keep track of all this stuff. And what it boils down to is you need to date them all at once. Just every girl you know, you need to be dating. A little bit.
Right, but not too much.
So, yes, you have to control your stats, which will determine which girls you meet, how many you know at a time, and how they are all regarding you. Because if you make one feel dissed or neglected for too long, she can bomb you, which means spread rumors that will lower your stats and your regard and esteem among all the girls. This just seems chaotic, psychotic. It's so much. I don't think this is how it really works, Dan.
Yeah, I don't think in real life you make everyone happy when you're dating the most possible different women. But there is something, it's like psychologically, they say, again, this is just pop psychology. I have no idea how true or false this actually is, but I've heard it, that you become more desirable as a potential partner if that woman sees you with another woman, because then it, like, it triggers, like, the competitive mating or whatever, like, instincts that we have. Like, oh, she wants him. Well, now I need to want him. And so it's, you know, it's a classic experience, maybe not experience, but story where, you know, someone is dating someone else. And then as soon as they break up, nobody is interested in them anymore. Because also then it's like sending the psychological message that, well, hold on, if she broke up with him, now he's tarnished goods. What's wrong with him? I don't want to be seen with the one who was rejected by someone else. even if those things aren't conscious, I think the idea is that there's like some aspect of that in the social hierarchy, which maybe points to just a kernel of truth in this, that like if everyone likes you and everyone wants to be with you, then that makes more people even want to be with you more, which is like a positive feedback loop, you know?
Yeah. Positive feedback loop, I think, is the right term. And just the knowledge that I think in a lot of fields, once you stand out and one person wants you, you're liable to be wanted by others. And that you have to at least not alienate people. Things grow more complex because in addition to dating these 12 possible girls, you can take them to 12 possible locations. On each date, you are presented with 3 dialogue options, which will affect how they feel about you. Like, which one you choose, it's like Telltale games. They will remember that. But also, there's like calendar events. There's all the Japanese holidays, and when did you set your birthday, and when is Shiori's birthday, and what clubs are you in at the school? And, like, what birthday gifts are you giving people? What are you getting as birthday gifts? All of these are things that can cause the story to branch in different ways. Which encourages you, as Rogers will point out, to try again. Try for different possible outcomes. So the 3rd and 4th hour of this YouTube video are dedicated to 2 different playthroughs. But it's not playthrough 1 and 2. It's playthrough 1 and playthrough 14. Because Tim Rogers played this game enough that he played through for every girl's outcome. And then he didn't even stop there. At least what he says is he played like the whole Tokimeki series and the side series and like was doing, you know, semi tangential, tied in, like, viewing television dramas and just, like, pulling in all the possible media he could talk about. And I wonder how much of this is even real, or if he's doing multiple things at once, or how it worked out. But he definitely played the game many times. And the way that he frames it is that the 2 playthroughs he's going to highlight are the ones where he pursues Shiori. And the first playthrough, he's going to try to do it naturally. Make the choices that make sense to him to get to that end result. Play through as though it were his very first time playing the game. And that doesn't work. He ends up not succeeding in his goal. But, he says, in his 14th playthrough, he does succeed, and yet is just as miserable. He says, miserable failure and miserable success.
I found this really evocative.
Also, while he was in the process of editing the video, before he turned it over to us, the viewers, he says he played 6 more times. So, 20 times total. But yeah, evocative. Because, what are some things we see in these playthroughs, Dan?
So there's a few ways you can talk about this right here. So you can talk about like what he actually discusses. And I'm also interested in like the very nature of the format of what he's doing, of like talking about this in such depth and the way that he kind of obsessively captures details and thoughts about this. So the first bit, like what is he actually talking about? I mean, he kind of shares things that happen and he's got like full high-def screen captures of them, so you're seeing it play out, and he's narrating over it, but including some of the sound clips from the game, which is all in Japanese. He talks about how there's been all these different releases on different platforms, but how a bunch of them have really good voice acting. But of course, it's Japanese-only voice acting. So we hear some of that, and then he translates it for us, and he kind of calls to our attention some aspects of the presentation, like the way that they react to certain things, some things about how they say things, or like what we can be led to read from their reactions and stuff.
Right, subtle changes to their facial expressions.
And it's interesting because he kind of treats it as like the psychology of a real person, and essentially argues that like that it is sufficiently sophisticated in its programming that it behooves us to treat these as real people and like trying to respect them as such, I guess, and like think about how they might react to things as such.
You sound dismissive.
I mean, he also later comes to the conclusion that everything is a formula and a set of numbers that's operating under the hood, which is kind of how I feel too, especially a game that's like this branching. At some point, it's you're just like submitted to the algorithm, but in a way that's presented to make you feel like you're immersed in the story, I guess. But that said, I didn't really begrudge him the way that he talked about it. Like, I didn't. I think he was on his bullshit again. Like, I think it was a little exaggerated, but I did appreciate the earnestness. I found it very infectious, actually, like very contagious, the enthusiasm that he felt and like the topics that he's talking about, like nostalgia and even phantom nostalgia of like what your life could have been, really resonated with me. Because like this is, if you've ever heard me talk about stories that I've written or I've read or movies that we've talked about, what's a Dancor movie? Like this whole coming of age thing and like figuring out who you are as a person and how that relates to like who you want to spend the rest of your life with and who makes your heart feel full has always been something that's been extremely evocative to me. And he takes that very seriously and like brings himself into it too, which again, I found infectious.
Right. So this would have been perfect for time loop month discussion. It's very much about time loops because the way that it shakes out when he plays through the game is he definitely doesn't succeed with Shiori the first time. Because to succeed with Shiori, you need to have like top stats in every category and also be rebuffing all the other girls and avoiding the bombs. And it's like spinning 12 plates at once. It's just chaos. And he gets into some of the things we talked about when we watched Groundhog Day, which is like, if you win somebody over by just memorizing all the right things to say and the right places to be over the course of a day or a year, what have you accomplished? And we talked about how that was like really manipulative and it was a power imbalance and you were like pulling the wool over the eyes of the woman by doing this. And just like you've lived a million lifetimes and that just gives you such an advantage that it is inherently exploitative. Tim Rogers, though, also points out that you lose yourself in doing that. Like, if you're just remembering the quote-unquote right things to do, you're not acting like yourself. Yourself is lost, which I found interesting. Specifically, he has an encounter in the game where he's on a date with Shiori, and they're, like, at a fair or something. And he sees, well, there's like a comment from the character, the protagonist character in the game that he like looks off to the side and he says that there's a hero show going on down the boardwalk, which I guess is like a Power Rangers thing, like a Super Sentai demonstration. But in one of his other playthroughs, he knows that Shiori doesn't like Power Rangers. And so he makes the protagonist character ignore the hero show. And it's like, oh, well, for romantic success, do you need to, like, forget your own hobbies? Do you need to not watch Power Rangers because that's a dorky thing to do? And that'll lose you points on your stats, Dan.
it's interesting. I mean, obviously, like, it, as you've been saying here, he draws in his own beliefs and philosophies and like how it made him think about his own life. And also just your philosophy playing a game like this, which is a role-playing game of sorts. Normally when you think of an RPG, it's you're shooting something or stabbing something, fighting it in some way to get experience. But here, instead of doing violence, you're doing dialogue and wooing. And he talks a little bit about that, about the concept of objectifying your target, whatever the target is. And also, like, he talks a little bit about the concept of min-maxing, which is like where you exactly what you said, where you're playing to like maximize the likelihood of a thing you want, not quote unquote true role playing, which is like where you do what you think you should do, which is the spirit of a role playing game. You're the one in the game. You should be doing what you want to do, not necessarily buffing this stat or that stat just to optimize the game. You know, it makes me think of one time we played a board game, Brian. It was hosted by our friend Colton. It was not Eldritch Horror, Arkham Horror, I think it's called. And you were a magician. And there was like things you could do to change your stats, and you refused to do it. You said it's the magician's code. And I appreciated that. You were the magician. You had to play like you thought a magician would play.
Yeah, that was the name I decided that night to give to my own habit of playing games, which is if it gives you the option to spend a turn on exchanging your tiles, don't do it. I don't do it. I feel like those were my God-given tiles. I don't get to have say over what I was dealt by the hand of destiny.
And I respect that, yeah.
It made me think of the Seinfeld episode where George is going to do the opposite of his instincts, and suddenly he becomes really successful. It's like any interaction he has during the day, he's going to resist his instincts. And he skyrockets to acclaim.
A classic. Dude, the more that we talk about this, the more connections I have to You Belong With Me. It's crazy.
Which, at this point, I guess we'll say is what we're going to talk about in addition. That's what Dan has brought to the table. And I don't believe that you decided this before watching the video.
I genuinely did. I had a short list of a few things I was going to talk about. And I'll tell a little bit more about this, but I definitely picked this before I actually started watching.
That's impressive because it like blew my mind. I started up the music video. I thought, whoa. And yeah, the reason that I like this Tokimeki video so much is how often Tim Rogers brings his own life into it. And it's like he's living every stage of his life at once. And very much, there's this phrase that he uses when he's talking about how, like, in the 12th playthrough and the 13th playthrough, he's remembering things that he learned in the previous playthroughs and these different lives that he's lived. He talks about that previous life long ago, which is also saying that he is remembering these past moments in his own life that have gone by, and yet they persist in a way, or at least the lessons that we learn persist.
One thing, Brian, that he brings up fairly early is the concept, the thought exercise that I certainly have engaged in myself. We might have even talked about it on the pod before. I think we did. But if you were given the option, would you transport back to your high school days, let's say, kind of having learned the lessons that you have subsequently learned in the subsequent 20 years since you graduated? And he says that he doesn't believe anyone who says no, that basically everyone should and would do this. And my answer is actually no. And the reason my answer is no, and I actually know the moment that I went from yes to no on this, it was when I had my kids, because like that kind of grew my heart in a certain way that like if there was a possibility that reliving my life, I didn't end up with my specific kids, that to me was scarier than like the opportunity cost of going back in time. Because I do agree with his general thesis that like once you have kind of a perspective of a grown up and you've been through it once and you kind of understand all of the opportunities you have there and all of the just the openness of potential of life, that you should want to go back there. Like that should be your default response. And that kind of is mine. But I still think that if you gave me that chance right now, I would say no.
I would probably make the jump if given the choice. I probably would have preferred to jump up to a couple years ago. Like I feel like I learned things in 2020 that are just better going forward with that knowledge. So there's something to be said with you I mean, it's all hypothetical. Nobody is time jumping. To quote the 1998 Merlin TV movie, the arrow of time points in one direction only, Dan. But it is a nice thought exercise. Because, yeah, why wouldn't you use your knowledge to maybe get a better playthrough? A better dialogue option. Now I want to just call out a few highlights of the video. Little moments that you appreciated. Because there's a couple things that I quite like. There's a lot of non sequiturs. A lot of little, like, offshoots of what gets talked about. One of the gags I really, really like is he has this whole theory of dates to the Arboretum. One of the 12 places that you can go on a date is to an arboretum where they have trees to look at. And according to his calculations, this is the most mid date. It's the date that doesn't get anybody too hot and bothered. He says you can cool down anyone with the arboretum.
This was pretty funny.
Also, he points out, he keeps saying that Yoshio, the male friend who keeps the crib sheet on how the girls are feeling, is a creep. And one of the reasons that he says Yoshio is creepy is that he has tall eyes. And how much weight he gives it when he says, Yoshio's tall eyes, makes me laugh.
I didn't even really think about that, but you're right, that is pretty funny.
And yeah, his character model is like just slightly different in the way the eyes are drawn. And the way the camera like zooms in is a highlight for me. Are there bits that clung to you, Dan?
You know, I was more taken with the earnestness and the reflection than the comedy. There definitely is some funny stuff. One thing he did a lot and that usually got a chuckle out of me is when he would kind of get on a tangent about how there was like a kind of creepy male gaze element to it. He frequently shows this one shot of the game of one of the girls sunbathing with her bikini top, like unfastened, and just kind of highlighting that there is an element of maybe not skeeviness, but like, I don't know what all the genres of manga and anime are, but like something about like a harem-esque element to this, I guess. And he brings a couple more of those up too. He overall downplays it, but you can see why this from the outside, if you only took certain moments of it, might have the reputation for being those weird and kind of creepy Japanese dudes made this game.
Right. And that's Mira Kagami, the girl who appears if you max your looks stat. Which leads me to my next question, Dan, which is, which girl would you have gone after in Tokimeki Memorial?
To be honest, I didn't really internalize who all the different ones were. I liked hearing him talk about why he was drawn to the one athletic girl and how that related to his own history. Wasn't there like a techie one, though? I like the techie type girls and the bookish type girls. So when he would talk about those, I'd be like, okay, I can see the appeal of that one.
Yeah, my pick is Yuina, the tech girl, who is the mad scientist. She's like the yandere, and she uses you for experiments and laughs when you're electrocuted.
Yeah, that's a good one. So I'll throw a semi-tangent in right here, which is my favorite game of all time is Mass Effect 2 from 2010. Have you played any of the Mass Effect games, Brian?
I haven't.
So one of the things I like about Mass Effect 2, so it was a trilogy of games, Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3. And Mass Effect 2 had like a really thin overall story. Basically, there's this one creepy race of aliens, and there's like kind of three quests you need to go on, and then you can go smoke them out of their base. And that's it as far as the main quests. But the rest of the gameplay is, you're like on a spaceship and you have these different crew members and you go on these, they're called loyalty missions, where you basically go on these quests to learn more about these characters and help them resolve some unfinished business. And as you do it, you get to know more about the character. And if you get them to like the happy ending of their loyalty quest,
they like when you dialogue them, when you're just hanging out on your ship in between missions, they open up to you more. And a whole bunch of the characters, you can actually like go down a romantic path with them, which has been the source of some cynicism online. Like, oh, it's basically like a horny simulator as well as like a shooty game. But I actually really like this aspect a lot. Like, first of all, it connects more with like the characters and you just care more about them if you can like also be able to connect with them on a romantic level, like in a real role playing aspect. And even more so, it basically like it really does feel a little bit more like role playing because the characters that you choose to get closest with, whether just like through the dialogue options or even the romantic options, you kind of says something about like who you view your version of the captain to be. His name is Commander Shepard, and he can be like all sorts of different things. That's part of what Mass Effect is all about, is you can be a renegade who's kind of a badass and doesn't go by the book. Or you can be like a paragon, which is someone who does follow the rules. And each of them, each of the different characters in the game, like kind of represents some aspect of what Commander Shepard could be. And I always liked that, you know, it wasn't just a way to like, oh, I'm going to have my character kiss the blue skinned alien. Like, it actually had a role playing element. That's one of the things that when he was talking about the game that resonated with me is like, it's not just which of the pretty anime girls are you going to make your dude kiss, but like, it's as you are living through this high school experience as this 14-year-old, what are the things that you define as important, and how to, and then that kind of refracts as who do you fall in love with. And I really felt that when I played Mass Effect 2 as well.
Right. I think that's what's most evocative about this video. And if I'm going to give it one demerit, it's that, so he gives us a couple anecdotes about past, like what might have been relationships that he experienced. The swim team girl in the game who appeals to him, he relates to a real girl that he had a crush on in high school who was on the swim team. And like several of the anecdotes he keeps checking back in with over the course of these 6 hours that we spend with him. And he says that at one point, like in his 30s, he did run into this woman again and said that he had had a crush on her back in the day, and they actually did go on a date to White Castle, I suppose. So that was a good story. But there's this other one that he, like, really builds mystique up about. Something that happened on the 13th of September, and he keeps intimating that he's going to tell you what happened. That, like, it led somewhere, that he, like, knew this woman for years and years, built up, like, a professional and then a friendly relationship with her. And then it's, like, lost in the shuffle. He never tells you how that story ends. And I wonder, maybe, hasn't one of your brothers watched other Action Button reviews?
Yeah, I think Will has.
I wonder if the final chapter of this story is in another video. I feel like in the movie Bedknobs and Broomsticks, there's a spell book that the main character has the book up until like halfway through the crucial spell and is looking for who has the other half of this book. That's how I'm feeling. I want to know what happened on the 13th of September.
So was it this September 13th or September 15th? I thought I remembered hearing September 15th.
Okay, maybe it was 15th, but it's a specific date. And ultimately, it's unimportant which date it was because we don't know what happened on it.
Right. Now, if it was September 13th, that would be even more spooky because September 13th is a very important day for You Belong With Me, which I will talk about later as well. Different year, but yeah.
Okay. Well, we're almost there. After the two playthroughs of the game that are highlighted, there's like an hour spent on, so why should we care? What does this mean to the industry? What does it mean to me? And then the final hour is like an appendix. Like, it's just kind of rambling. The second and third time I watched this video, I just watched through the playthroughs. But I actually did appreciate this ending bit more now, because he actually, like, thanks people who have submitted their writing to him, which I guess a lot of people do. Hey, read my essay. Hey, read my review. And he singles out one person who sent something in and says, keep writing, you've got something. Which I appreciated this time. And I think it goes to show that you do build a community doing these reviews. Something we've experienced just the tiniest little sliver of. We don't get 2 million listens. But, I mean, I would want Tim Rogers to say that I wrote well. I think that carries some weight, even if his prose is very purple. And that's Action Button Reviews Tokimeki Memorial from the very first day of 2021. Do you agree, Dan, that it would have been good for Time Loop Month?
Yeah. Although, to me, that was just one component of it. You definitely could have included in it. But I don't know. I think, I guess, the way that he kind of wraps up his thoughts on it do kind of align with some of the values and that we talked about time loops essentially having to emphasize with the Groundhog Day rules that we kind of talked about. So I think, yeah, and obviously when he talks about going through it and seeing all the different realities of like running the different playthroughs, that very much is the essence of a time loop. He even talks about Groundhog Day in there. Yeah. A couple extraneous thoughts. One, the presentation's really good. He did a terrific job editing it, and that makes a big difference, I think. Like, he brings in music. I think he said the music was all from the game, although one of the compositions is basically just Clair de Lune by Debussy. I don't know if he pulled that in separately or if that's one of the songs in Tokimeki Memorial, but I liked the background music because it like sets the tone very well. And he pulls in like textures and images and stuff from it as background when he's talking too.
Also, there's a scrolling background in the game itself, and he has that same scrolling background as like a layer in the video.
Exactly. Yeah. And I guess to kind of go back to what I said a few minutes ago about like the way that he talks about it and the very essence of him doing this, I was also kind of using this as a referendum on long form YouTube videos. And so let's talk about that for a minute, because my general philosophy on life is albums should be 30 minutes, movies should be 90 minutes, podcasts should be 60 to 90 minutes. YouTube videos should be like 5 to 20 minutes. And when something is this long, it feels gratuitous. It's like, why is someone going to spend a quarter of a day watching this guy talk about something? And I have to say that I found it worthwhile. I also didn't convince myself that in general, long form YouTube videos are worthwhile. Because I think this guy's really good. And I think that's what it comes down to, is like, just like a good podcast. It's basically the same concept, but it's a video, you know? If you can hear someone talk about something in a way that's interesting to you and engage with it, that's cool. It's interesting that whole time. But it would depend. And I'm still not entirely sold that like the ideal YouTube video is going to be this long, or that even I personally want to spend a lot of time watching YouTube videos like this. First of all, any thoughts on that? I'm curious your thoughts. I also queried the Discord, which I can share some of the reactions we got there.
Sure. I watch a lot of long YouTube videos these days, or I listen to them in the background. I think recently I've talked about that streaming has kind of abolished old estimations, old restrictions on how long things should be. Like, since the beginning of recorded sound, at least, there's been industry standards on, okay, well, a song is 3 minutes long because that's how much you can fit on an Edison wax cylinder. Or, okay, TV, that's a half hour long, and you gotta have your station breaks. But now with Netflix, you don't have to do that anymore. It could be however long. You carry your little TV with you everywhere you go. You can consume it on your own schedule. And everybody can do that individually. There's no set air times. You can just leave off where you stopped the last time. the next time you get back in the car, you can resume the podcast. It is up to you. I think there are creators who can go too far with it. I don't think every YouTube video needs to be more than an hour long. A couple creators who I will shout out who I think make good long videos. One is Real Life Lore. You watched any of those, Dan?
No, I've never seen that.
So this is a guy, he does roughly like once a week, an hour long documentary about current events in a certain country. So like, why is Ethiopia the way that it is right now? Why is Saudi Arabia the way that it is right now? What has Venezuela been up to in recent years? And they're always like, well done. Like, he must be really busy.
That is interesting, yeah.
But always educational.
My brother Will on the Discord. So first of all, the Discord, join us if you're listening to this. It's at thegoodsfilmpodcast.com. We'd love to have you. So I basically brought up that we were going to talk about something that was a long YouTube video and what did different people think about that. And my brother Will, who always has an opinion on things, brought in his opinion, and I'm grateful for that. He said that he thinks comprehensive breakdowns of a topic are interesting, and especially if they are editorialized by someone who is good at articulating their opinions, which kind of matches what I'm saying. Like, I think if you're good at it, then it's good. You know, that's like, it's almost a reflexive statement. You know, if it's good, then it's good. But he called out H Bomber Guy. And like a few months ago, one of his videos went viral. Did you watch that one, Brian?
I watched an H Bomber Guy video, which was about Tommy Tallarico, which may be the one you're speaking of. That was about a year ago that I watched that.
I think this is a different one. This is about, well, it was about YouTube plagiarism, and it kind of touched different topics. But the bulk of it was about how this one creator had like just horribly and blatantly plagiarized and basically left a terrible trail of it, but still had built up a really dedicated community. And I thought he was good at telling it, but I also didn't think he got me to care. So I thought it ended up being kind of dumb that he was talking about it for 4 hours. Like, I don't care if one guy who makes YouTube videos that I don't watch plagiarized his videos. Like, that to me is not that interesting, even if you tell it pretty interestingly. But I can see like someone who's good at this, it requires a collection of skills. You need to, like, first of all, be able to write well. You need to be charismatic on screen. You need to be a good video editor. You need to be good at pacing things, which I guess is related to writing well. But it's impressive when it's done well. I just haven't spent that much time watching long form stuff. Right.
And of course, I like Jenny Nicholson's videos, which they really range in how long they can be. I think the last one about the theme park Evermore was very long, but they're not always long.
I've watched a couple of hers, but most of the ones I've watched have been less than a half hour. Another thing that I was thinking a little bit about is like taking, so this is kind of unrelated to the form itself, but just thinking about the way that he kind of obsessed over a single game. So I had this app on my phone called Campus Dynasty, and it's a college basketball simulator. And it has an entirely fictional universe of college basketball. Each of the schools is based off a real one, but they're like fake. And I made it my goal to win a title with all 256 different schools in that, as just like when I'm sitting down and playing for 5 minutes, you can do that for 5 minutes. And I got really far in it. I started tracking it in a spreadsheet. So I was relating to him when he was talking about like getting over obsessed and really trying to understand the calculus of different mechanics and optimizing them. It felt a little bit less gross doing it in a basketball game than doing it in like a social life simulator. But my file corrupted when I had like 15 left or something.
No!
Like that. I got really far. And I thought about like essentially starting a new one and just trying to do it with the last 15, because it is kind of like a time loop in that you basically start from scratch when you go to a new school. But yeah, I didn't do that, but I related to it. He also talked a little bit about, I don't think he actually used this phrase, but basically the concept of emergent gameplay, where like
what's presented right in front of you isn't necessarily that rich of a story itself, but the way that it generates stories in your brain is what makes that interesting. So like Mass Effect is not that. Mass Effect, it's all there on the screen. You're getting like terrific presentation with a rich story. But when I play games like The Sims 3, for example, which I had played hundreds and hundreds of hours of, that's, I'm all about that. That's like, you start to like develop goals for yourself and like telling your stories about what your characters are and stuff. And that's just so satisfying when you find the right game that like clicks in your brain that sort of way. And I've dabbled in video game development, but, and the kind of thing that I would want to make would be an emergent gameplay type experience that's more of like a sandbox than an actual scripted game. Like that would be much more my jam of something that I would be interested in. So I actually found the game that he was talking about it and the way he was thinking about it interesting to me too. Like I don't know if I would play this game now if it came out in English, but I think there was a time in my life when I would have been very drawn to the game itself because it sounds interesting, like imagining your own life and like making a game out of it in your head and a story out of it in your head.
Yeah. You know what it made me think of? So it's like a choose your own adventure book where kind of all the possibilities are already there in the box, but you're discovering the paths that lead there. And there was this one book in the series of Choose Your Own Adventure that comes up in like cracked articles and BuzzFeed listicles of, did you know that? And I'm going to look up the title. The title was Inside UFO 5440. And what made this one special is the story has you on a UFO that's bound for a treasure planet, like a Shangri-La heaven planet. But none of the paths lead you there. Yet there is a page in the book where you get to the treasure planet. And the only way you can find it is to cheat. Just check every page of the book. That's kind of how you have to win over Shiori Fujisaki. It's like that ending is in there, but no legitimate tactics will give you that result. And it in so doing, it kind of makes the whole thing a statement on the ludicrous nature of what you're doing and the like inhuman nature of what you're doing.
Yeah. I found that really interesting when he was talking about how basically what's her name? The main girl,
Shiori Fujisaki, Dan.
Shiori Fujisaki. I don't know why it didn't stick in my brain. Cause he says it about 10,000 times in those 6 hours, but how she basically becomes not even a character herself, but like a symbol of the girl that requires us to be perfect, like this image of a perfect girl that is just totally unattainable when there are all these other not quite so perfect people that could be the one for us. And how just pretty interesting way of that he kind of talks about it as like, even though like it kind of tries to raise her up, it ends up dehumanizing her even more and making her less of like a believable character that you care about in that way. It's pretty interesting. So, Brian, one thing I did is I think I already alluded to this, but I asked our Discord what they thought of long YouTube videos. And it was actually quite divisive. There was not at all a consensus. It was a pretty even mix of people who said they don't watch long YouTube videos. They'd much rather listen to podcasts or watch actual films. Which to me makes sense because like if I'm sitting down in front of a screen, I want to be consuming a movie in general, not always, but in general, whereas a podcast has some of the appeal of like a long YouTube video of someone talking about something they care about, but I can do it while doing something else. That was something that came up a couple times, but a bunch of others said they really like them. And one thing they mentioned is something that you kind of said, which is that you don't have to watch it in one sitting. You can watch it when you want to watch it in the way that you want to watch it, which I respect. I think that's kind of cool. You can be second screening it or while you're folding laundry or something like that.
I feel like it broke down kind of by age also. there's like a tipping point where the younger folks liked it and the older folks didn't embrace it as much. But also it's like a very fine, I mean, 1 year one way or the other could change your opinion, or that could just be a hokum theory.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Like, the people younger than me seem to say basically yes, they like to watch them, and the people older than me said basically no, they didn't. So maybe there's something to that.
But it's key, I think, that you bring up podcasts. I mean, we do a podcast, and the episodes tend to be pretty long. This episode is getting so long, my computer just crashed, and we had to reboot. It always seems like the episodes where we talk about nothing run the longest.
Who knows, Brian? It's Seinfeld, right?
Right.
So now we'll do our signature section, where we each give the not quite a movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, which is a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. So I guess I'll go first on, is Action Button Review's Tokimeki Memorial from 2021 good? And I kind of feel about this the same way I do other things, where I got something out of it. I don't entirely get it, which would usually put me at like a 5 or maybe a 6. But on the one hand, I really liked a lot of what it was, which makes me think 6. On the other hand, I felt like it was just drowned in 6 hours of content, which didn't always enhance it. Like, you probably could have gotten close to the same impact with like 2 hours or something. But I don't know. The length of it also does add a dimension to it. I'm going to give it a soft 6. Very soft 6. Very good. Because it honestly, it did inspire me. It made me want to be more like him when I talk about media that I love, the way that he did it, where it was earnest and personal and enthusiastic and unashamed of loving what he loved. I like that. And I'm going to try to take some of that away with me. But what about you, Brian? Is Action Button Review's Tokimeki Memorial good?
Yeah, I like this. And you described it more eloquently than I'm going to. So props for that. I think Tim Rogers is very well spoken. And that's why I think his seal of approval on somebody's writing as the very last beat of the video does carry some weight. I'm going to give this a 7. Exceptionally good. It's stuck with me over the years. I think it is a good musing on the same type of themes that come up in time loops, of the idea of living the same moment again, or even just thinking back and looking forward. Like, how can we take what we learn in the days and years of our lives and use that knowledge to steer us toward a better future? And what does it mean to have a simulation? I like this presentation. I think it's too long. That's what saves it from the 8, what holds it back. I think the Garfield video that's 1 hour is perfect. This didn't need to be 6 hours. Maybe 2 is a little tight. I don't think it needs to be more than 4. But it almost becomes like a bit of performance art, having it be so toweringly, monolithically long. So I don't know. I still think very highly of it. I'm glad that we finally got to watch it after years of me talking about it. But a little too long.
Yeah. No, I think there's something to that. And one thing that I didn't like is that he constantly referenced how long it was. And to me, that was a little bit too far. It was like, do your thing, but if your thing is not being self-conscious about it. So like, talking constantly about how long it is just didn't feel like in the right spirit of it, and just kind of annoying.
That's true. Yeah, too lampshady.
But that's all right.
One final thing about the video. There's a moment when I liked every time that he like explained an element of Japanese culture that I wouldn't know what it was. Like what a giri choko is. But he also had this moment when one of the girls is wearing a patterned ski jacket, and he's talking about like this prominent brand of Japanese ski jackets. And he said, okay, top 10 game jackets. And then he says, no, I'm not going to do that right now. But I really wish he had done that, because I was ready. I wanted to hear his thoughts on who had the best game jackets. And it made me think, Dan, that there have been at least twice on this podcast that you have pointed to a jacket in a movie and said, I like that jacket. Give me that jacket.
I remember the Zombies one. I don't remember what the other one is.
Zombies was the one I listened back to recently, but I know it's come up at least one other time. So we got to do like a transcribe or something. Just yeah. to find where it is, but I know it's happened.
Okay, that's good. No, man, I like a good jacket. Yeah, for sure. And I would watch top 10 video game jackets. Absolutely. So do we want to switch to my half of the pod, Brian?
Let's do it, Dan.
All right.
You've waited long enough.
I'm excited about this. Check in soon for part 2 of our April Fool's Day episode.